From the Sky News Centre at 5. There's been an angry reaction from relatives of 9/11 victims to confirmation the alleged mastermind will stand trial in a civilian court. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other men who are currently detained at Guantanamo Bay will be tried in New York. US Attorney General Eric Holder says the suspects will face the maximum punishment.
These were extraordinary crimes, and so we will seek maximum penalties. I fully expect to direct prosecutors to seek the death penalty against each of the alleged 9/11 conspirators.
The family of a woman who was murdered for a posting she made on Facebook say her killer's the devil incarnate. John McFarlane murdered Mary Griffiths after she put a message on the website saying he was delusional if he thought they'd have a relationship. The air industry's biggest union, Unite, has warned it will not back British Airways' merger with Iberia without a jobs guarantee. It wants the airline to promise not to make compulsory redundancies. But Mick Ricks from the GMB union says the tie-up could actually save jobs in the long term.
This merger is about securing the next 25 years of British Airways' existence, which will actually guarantee and secure future employment in this country for British Airways staff.
The father of a boy who it was feared had blown away in a homemade helium balloon has told a court the whole incident was a hoax. Richard Heaney admitted deceiving the emergency services when his son Falcon was reported missing in Colorado last month. Harry Potter star Daniel Radcliffe's considering legal action over newspaper allegations he smoked cannabis at a party. In response to the Daily Mirror story, his spokeswoman says he only lit up a rolled tobacco cigarette. And forecasters warning us about a wet and windy 24 hours ahead. Southwest England and Wales are set to be worst affected, with gusts up to 75 miles an hour. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and joining us live in the studio to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is the brains behind this weekend's Alternative View Conference in Bristol City Centre, which has pulled in speakers from around the world. That's Ian Crane. Our regular Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. As the conspiracy conference is in town this weekend, Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol asking you what you think about the Princess Diana's Paris car crash in 1997. Did she fall? Or was she pushed? And does it matter? Also, in the second hour from 6, Billy Quain will be along with his guide to what's on for free over the weekend. After that, at about 20 past 6, we have one of the speakers at the Alternative View Conference, Anthony Hilder, from the United States, here in the studio. And he'll be explaining why he thinks our government and media are in the grip of what he calls the New World Order. We'll be discussing this week's news in a moment, but here is at first is our two-week weekend Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. And the averaging around about 9 degrees Celsius this weekend, the fairly rainy, and windy, but maybe some sunny spells on Sunday afternoon. So I think the idea is to keep your brolly with you most of the weekend, apart from later on Sunday. Next week, averaging 10 degrees Celsius, wet and fairly windy week. Tuesday and Friday are looking the driest days. That's Tuesday and Friday. Next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of November, averaging 13 degrees Celsius, so it's warming up a little bit, fairly rainy and windy on Saturday, and Sunday is looking drier and sunnier. That was a long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight or so from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and with us in the studio this week, as I said, is the organiser of the Alternative View Conference, which is taking place at the Grand Thistle Hotel in Broad Street this weekend, Ian Crane. Ian, welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for the invitation. Good to be back.
And you used to be an oil worker. So who for and what did you do?
Well, I worked for a company called Schlumberger in the oil field services industry. And well, I was operating in a managerial level, so you know, I tended to keep my hands clean, as it were. but was operating all over the world, the Middle East, United States, mainland Europe, and the UK, of course.
What about the energy industry? What sort of insight did working in the oil business do for you there?
Well, a number of things, but perhaps the most significant experience I had, of course, was when I went into Kuwait in 1991. Late March 1991, in the immediate aftermath of hostilities there. And of course, the media had presented the case that Saddam Hussein's forces had set the oil wells alight in Kuwait as they retreated. Well, my personal experience tells a slightly different story, because it very much looked to me as though the American Special Forces had had teams in there setting the wells alight after they had mopped up the Iraqi forces there. And actually, I did corroborate that in 2003 with some correspondence with some former US Special Forces personnel who confirmed that they were part of the teams that set the wells alight.
Interesting. Well, also, one of the things that frustrates me about the oil industry is we go down the street, we see all these different petrol stations. We've got Shell, BP, we've got Esso, and they all seem to have almost the same prices, and they all go up and down at the same time, even though they've got their own, often got their own refineries. So do you think there's a bit of price fixing going on there?
Price fixing in the strictest sense of the term, no, but do they collude informally? Absolutely, of course they do, because they can't afford to have competition. I mean, the reality is that we have to also remember, of course, that in the UK, the bulk of the cost of a litre of fuel is tax. So last year, when the price of a barrel of oil went up to $147, and we saw the media showing Gordon Brown going over to Saudi Arabia ostensibly to persuade the Saudis to lower the oil price, they just laughed and they said, Mr. Brown, you need to lower your taxes.
You say that they can't afford it. They can't afford competition. It's an interesting phrase to use, but hang on a minute. These oil companies are the richest, some of the richest corporations, if not the richest corporations in the world, turning billions and billions of profits.
Absolutely. I mean, the oil industry is...
So they can afford to, can't they? They can afford to compete?
Well, they probably can, but they don't. yeah, I mean, the oil industry accounts for close on 5% of global GDP. And, what we've seen now, I think, at least three times in the last 40 years, is that each time the price of oil reaches 7% of global GDP, the world can no longer afford it and the price comes crashing down. The price comes crashing down because, fundamentally, we go into recession after that. And, basically that's exactly what occurred in the middle of last year, when the price of oil dropped from $147 down to $35 a barrel, which was, incredible. Now, I have to say that in all probability, $35 a barrel is too low. I think the current pricing of circa $70, $75 is probably what we're going to see sustained for quite some time, because this is actually what's financing a lot of the new exploration. And those people who talk about peak oil conveniently forget what's actually occurring in the real world, because when the price went up to over $100, then exploration became the order of the day. And the peak oil pundits say we've used more oil in the last 30 years than we discovered. Well, that actually was quite true, but we weren't looking for it because we thought we knew where there was enough oil for the next 100 years.
Because the idea of peak oil is basically that that there is we've reached the maximum kind of consumption that we can take out of the oil reserves. Is that correct?
That's correct, based on existing technology.
Right, and existing exploration as well.
And existing exploration. But, I mean, we've discovered massive reserves over the last... 2 years basically, and exploration is now at the highest level that it's been for almost 30 years.
Okay, why the conference?
Why the conference? Well, this is the third in the series, the Alternative View, and I've got to tell you that after running Alternative View 1, I never had any intention of running Alternative View 2, but the reaction was such that we decided that we could raise it above the level of AV1, which we held in the Civic Hall in Totnes.
So what's the raison d'être? What is it that, how do you choose the people that you're going to come and have a talk? And a lot of these people, of course, aren't very well-known names. I mean, Norman Baker is an MP, he's quite well-known, but a lot of the people on your list there speaking over the weekend, many people won't have heard of them.
Well, they won't have heard of them because most of these people will be ignored by the mainstream media. Because the mainstream media certainly doesn't want to draw attention to them. So the best way to do that is just to ignore them. And that's why we have the tagline in the advertisement that appeared in yesterday's Evening Post, which is the truth rarely spoken by politicians, big pharma, or the mainstream media. And that's why we're really pleased to be able to welcome Cynthia McKinney, a six-term former US Congresswoman, and the Green Party presidential candidate in last year's US presidential elections. But, you know, she really came to the fore when, as Congresswoman for Atlanta in the US, she challenged Donald Rumsfeld very pointedly. And in fact, the challenge was such and so effective that the Republicans made sure she didn't get re-elected in the next congressional election.
And of course, Donald Rumsfeld stepped down not long after. Anyway, Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, we're going to be talking about it in the second hour, the New World Order. Do you have any truck with this idea of an organised conspiracy or a New World Order?
Well, I think the problem with the word New World Order is simply one of terminology. Clearly, things are going on behind the scenes. I mean, whether you call it New World Order or you just call it capitalist conspiratorialism or whatever. I mean, the problem with the word New World Order is it kind of conjures certain things in people's minds. I mean, it was used originally, as I understand it, by George Bush Sr. in discussing the aftermath of the first Gulf War that Ian mentioned earlier. But and it was also used by the Nazis, of course, to describe what they were going to do. But we shouldn't get confused by terminology. The question is, what do we mean by the term? And that's where the arguments start.
OK, so anyway, let's now take a look at some of this week's news stories. And I'd like you to start on this one, if you don't mind, Ian. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we have a lot of... it was in the news we just heard at the top of the hour, is going on trial again in New York this time, and in a civil trial. So it's not going to be some kind of military kangaroo court. This is going to be a proper trial. So at last, maybe, we're going to get to the bottom of whether this chap was really responsible, the mastermind of the September the 11th attacks.
Somehow I doubt that. Somehow I see that what we're going to witness is a Hollywood-style stage-managed event. And, I mean, let's take one fundamental fact into account here. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times.
Yeah, what exactly? I mean, we've heard this term. What exactly is waterboarding?
Well, waterboarding is a form of torture. It is torture. I mean, it's not a form of torture. It is torture. And basically, the way it works is that the recipient of this treatment is laid on their back with their feet raised. So their feet are raised above their head. And their head is obviously down the bottom end of this slope. They have a cloth put over their face, and water is poured over the cloth, and it actually simulates drowning. Now, what causes the real effect on the person is not so much the water, which creates this perception of drowning, but it's the build-up of carbon dioxide in the lungs, which then is pushed into the bloodstream, and it creates a sense of panic and imminent death. Now, for the vast majority of people, to be waterboarded one time, they would probably admit to anything. I mean, I can promise you, you waterboard me and I'll tell you whatever you ask me to tell you.
You'll sign anything.
I'll sign anything, exactly. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times. I mean, this guy's evidence cannot be credible in a court of law.
Well, let's see if it all stands up. Well, Martin, I mean, surely that's the test, isn't it? It will his confession, or whatever it is he's signed here, stand up in a court of law? Isn't that
the
test?
In a British court of law, if his lawyers can prove that he was tortured, then the case would have to be dropped. It's as simple as that. And let's see whether US justice stands to those basic principles of Magna Carta or not.
So are you saying that you don't think that this chap was the mastermind of September the 11th? If not, why are the Americans doing this?
Well, as you well know, as I've said on this programme for several times over the last few weeks, the former head of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, General Leonid Ivashov, is on the record in Russia as saying, as far as he's concerned, 9/11 was an inside job carried out by the American and Israeli security forces. Now, you may make what you wish of that.
With what motives?
In order to create a pretext for invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq because they want to get the oil. I mean, it's not that straightforward. It's perfectly straightforward, really. I mean, it's not actually very, very convoluted. It's actually staring people in the face. I mean, the question is, did they do it? But I ask your listeners to consider, I suggest that the chief of staff of the Russian armed forces is one of the small handful of people on the planet who probably does know who did it. And you'd have to come up with a very complicated explanation why he would be lying about that.
So, Ian, carry on.
Well, today is actually the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan.
That's right.
So, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan was launched basically 2 months after 9/11. It's very evident that the game plan to invade Afghanistan was well in place before 9/11. And I mean, let's not forget that it is a matter of public record, as reported by a Pakistani diplomat, that the US officials that were negotiating with the Taliban to build an oil pipeline for Occidental across Afghanistan, which the Taliban didn't want any truck with. And the US official that was negotiating reportedly said, "We are offering you a carpet of gold, but you reject our offer and you will get a carpet of bombs."
So just explain, what was the outcome of that then? Well, surely the Taliban would have said to him, "Look, you know, what are you talking about? You can't bomb us. I mean, you know, we've got the United Nations, we've got the whole world watching."
Well, of course, the Taliban were under some pressure because of their oppression of women. And I'm not for one moment sort of making any kind of comment. I mean, Afghanistan is, you know, is a completely different culture. But, you know, a lot of it is often made of the opium trade. Well, let's not forget that the Taliban had effectively shut down the opium trade. And that actually caused a problem for the West, but that's a whole other subject. But so subsequent to the invasion, we've now got opium production at record levels. We've got a pipeline in place for Occidental, which obviously gives exactly the feed that they wanted out of the Central Asian fields. So I think it's very clear that, you know, this war that is losing the hearts and minds, obviously, of the British public, we shouldn't be there in the first place. It's an illegal war. You know, the pretext of the Taliban hosting Osama bin Laden is just complete fabrication. I mean, the Taliban stated categorically, "You give us the evidence, you know, and if we find him, we'll hand him over to you." But, you know, he wasn't there in the first place, period. But this pretext was outrageous. And, of course, we are losing, you know, a phenomenal number of British servicemen in a war that is unwinnable, totally unwinnable. I mean, the Russians saw that. What makes the British and Americans or the UN think that they can achieve in Afghanistan what the Russians couldn't achieve in, what was it, 19 years?
It's about 10 years before they were driven out. We're reaching the same sort of turning point, aren't we?
Well, okay, so thanks very much for that comment on the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial, which has just been announced this afternoon. Let's move on to our next story, and this is something which is, I think, probably a little bit closer to home, since we have two projected new nuclear power stations here around, not in the Bristol Channel, around the Bristol Channel. I must not say that, in the Bristol Channel. There's one at Oldbury and one at Hinkley Point, possibly. This is one of the big stories of the week. A total of 10 new nuclear power stations will be built that could supply up to 25% of the country's power needs. The Energy Secretary, one of the most important aspects of the story, is that he has swept away previous planning rules which held up previous building plans for up to 6 years. And they're saying now that these nuclear power stations will be fast-tracked and that the planning process will only take a year. Ian, again, do you want to come at this maybe from the sort of energy policy and energy supply point of view?
This is not a one-dimensional story by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, what has been fascinating is for me is that over the last few days the mainstream media have been running all the stories that they should have been running in the immediate run-up to the European elections in June.
Why do you say that?
Well, because what we're now seeing in the media is more explanation of just the amount of power and the decision-making that is being handed over to Brussels under the Treaty of Lisbon. Now, all of this should have been pointed out to the British public in the run-up to the European elections. But what were what was the media full of in the run-up to the European elections? All of the MPs' expenses scandal. And that was a Freudian slip. Okay. Because it was a scam. The MPs were set up. An ace was created that could be played at a given time to keep the real story off the front pages. So what we see here, actually, this is not the British government making this decision. And what we need to understand is that with the signing of the ratification of the Treaty of Lisbon, the UK no longer owns the North Sea oil. We have effectively surrendered the UK's resources to Brussels.
Well, this is new to me. I mean, is this, you're talking, saying it's a little bit like the fishing fleets were 20 years ago, that Brussels now has some kind of jurisdiction over our oil reserves under the North Sea.
Not some kind of jurisdiction, total control. This is not owned by the UK.
So do you think that this decision is related to that then?
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
Because Britain, of course, is the perfect country, or one of the perfect countries, for building a mass of nuclear power stations. Now, you know, we're talking about nuclear power stations that feed into the European grid. Now, to build a nuclear power station, relatively cheaply, use the term loosely, you need to build it on a coastline. And of course, Britain has that coastline. I mean, France actually, I think, generates quite a significant percentage of its electricity from nuclear power stations, and they had a program some 20 years ago. But now what's happening is, yes, Britain is not going to be able to rely on North Sea oil, North Sea gas, regardless of whether it's running out or not, and I don't believe it is, but regardless of whether it is or isn't, because we don't control it, but to offset the fact that that oil and gas is going to be fed effectively into the European arena, now we have the effective instruction. I mean, I believe this is an EU instruction that Britain has to build these nuclear power stations, and this is Miliband trying to present it as a Labour decision.
Well, I mean, coming first of all to nuclear power, I think that nuclear power is not viable economically. It's fairly clear that you have to have a huge lead time of investment to get anything. But I mean, the French are committed now because it's something like 60 or 70% of their electricity is generated by nuclear power. They've sunk costs into it over generations. And, of course, they want to build more nuclear power stations. They will get the contracts. So I certainly agree that there's pressure from the French for us to build these nuclear power stations because of the, you know, the path-dependent way in which the French economy has developed with nuclear power at its core. The stuff about North Sea oil, I mean, to my mind, North Sea oil is actually controlled by US corporations. It always has been since we started taking it out in 1979 in the Norwegian section of the North Sea. And they're not part of the EU, of course. They've got their own state-owned oil company, Statoil. And they took their time in taking their oil out. They built their own infrastructure, trained up their own people. They didn't just bring in people from outside as we did. And, of course, they've now got a huge sovereign wealth fund, which is going to pay for nursery schools in Norway for the next 30 or 40 years. Our money has all gone on unemployment benefits, whiskey and prostitutes.
Oh, well, that's a bit depressing. Now, just also... It's worthwhile pointing out that the local Liberal Democrats put out a press release about this week, and they're saying that they're condemning government plans to fast-track new nuclear reactors near Bristol. Oldbury in Gloucestershire and Hinckley in Somerset have both been chosen as sites for new nuclear reactors, and this is Dr Mark Wright, who is Lib Dem challenger for Bristol South in the general election, says these are the actions of an arrogant government with no vision for a different future. He's also saying, make no mistake, the taxpayer will end up feathering the nest of the nuclear energy companies, just like we ended up feathering the nest of irresponsible banks. Now, it is a bit frustrating, isn't it, sitting here in Bristol, because these are both taking place in other areas. This is one of the Bristol, obviously, is quite close to these places, but it's going to be, I think, South Gloucestershire, or at least Gloucestershire, the Oldbury one, and Somerset. So is it going to make any difference, do you think, Martin, that Bristol councillors, or even possibly Bristol Council itself, since it's controlled by the Lib Dems, is going to oppose this?
Well, not if the planning regulations are as they are, which basically allow developers, in this case nuclear power generators, to do what they want in the final analysis. I think this won't happen. You know why it won't happen? Because they simply can't afford it. There's just no money to subsidise nuclear power. And despite the promises that the Labour government clearly has made to the nuclear industry, I can't see, as we go forward and the economy gets into even worse mess than it already is, as it undoubtedly will, that we're going to have the resources for this huge white elephant.
But I mean, if what Ian's saying is correct, surely the European Central Bank can come along and finance it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, when Miliband actually said that this will not cost the British taxpayer, well, he has the inside track. He knows it's not going to cost the British taxpayer. It will ultimately, of course, because we're going to be paying more and more taxes into Europe. And by the way, I don't think we're very far away now from seeing a federal tax on top of national income tax, just like exists in the USA. But fundamentally, yes, because the instruction has, in my opinion, come down from the EU, it will ostensibly be funded by the EU.
OK, on to our next story. And this is the lottery. 90 million winners are revealed. Now, this was a story that was at the beginning of the week. Two tickets will take 45 million share of Friday's 90 million euro millions jackpot. Now, what are your thoughts on the Euro lottery? Martin, do you want to start on this one?
This isn't the British National Lottery. This is a Euro lottery.
Yes, that's right. But £90 million prizes.
Well, Adam Smith long ago said that lotteries are a tax upon all the fools in creation. You can't get money off people as tax. People resist tax increases, but if you say you've got a chance of winning something, then they'll happily hand over a large chunk of their income on the possibility of winning, which is actually you're much more likely to catch HIV or be killed in a car accident. I don't buy lottery tickets. You might have gathered that.
So have you got? Is that a lottery sticker I can see sticking out of your pocket there, Ian?
Oh, quite possibly. You know, I agree with what Martin said there. I think it was Lorenzo in the 1880s when Italy was formed after the dissolution of the Vatican States, the Papal States, and the new government of Italy asked Lorenzo to advise them on how they could raise money, and God knows how much they paid Lorenzo, but he came back with three words in his report, and his response was tax the poor. He said, you know, the only way you raise money is tax the poor, because if you raise taxes on the wealthy, they either have the means to be able to leave the country and go elsewhere or pay people to find ways to avoid the taxes. Now, the challenge, of course, then is to be creative and find ways to tax the poor. And the lottery is a classic. Yeah. An absolute classic. Absolutely.
But yes, but what happens here is that the money that's raised from the lottery goes to all sorts of good causes.
Well, can I just comment on that? I mean, I don't know what happens with the Euro lottery money, but British national lottery money, there's a whole parallel, that's the thing I most dislike about it, a whole parallel bureaucracy has been created to distribute the money. I mean, the El Gordo, the fat one, the Spanish national lottery, which has been there since the days of Franco, that money just goes into general funds for the government. So you could argue that, you know, people are being fleeced by being participants in the lottery, but at least they get some hospitals out of it. In Britain, we're not allowed to spend it on hospitals. It has to be on things that the state wouldn't otherwise fund. So there's a whole bureaucracy looking at things to spend it on, and a whole load of people are employed to do so.
Well, of course,
which I think is just absurd.
Much of it now is going on the Olympics, isn't it?
Well, indeed. And then people are sitting there on committees deciding which bit of the Olympics, and being paid to sit on those committees to decide which bit of the Olympics. Meanwhile, hospitals are requiring extra funds, but we can't use it for that because that's the way the lottery's been set up.
But Ian, surely, you know, there's something in everybody that wants to take a little flutter and, you know, have and to actually end up with a possible, you know, a bonus of something like £90 million, you know, there must be some, you must have some chance.
It is a very creative tax, and it builds on that wonderful word that has found its way into ever increasing usage in the British language, hope. Yeah. You know, we always have that eternal optimism. And, you know, yes, there is the element of choice and free will here. I mean, it's not a mandatory taxation. I mean, people do have the opportunity to opt in or opt out. But, you know, as for creating £90 million, was it pounds? Yeah, £90 million winner versus 180, you know, £500,000 winners. Yeah, you know, I think these people, their lives are going to be changed in ways that they have yet to even imagine.
Okay, so overall conclusion, this is a tax on hope and probably not such a good thing.
I think that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. Okay, next story. A couple flee to save their unborn baby from social workers after a girl, 17 years old, is told she's not clever enough to look after her child. Now, this was, I think, the Daily Mail was actually the only newspaper that covered this one. And we're told that a heavily pregnant woman and her fiancé have gone on the run after social workers threatened to take away their baby at birth. She's now pregnant. Kerry Robertson, 17, and Mark McDougall, 25, have been told she was not bright enough to raise their child and they would have to give him up at birth. What are your thoughts about this one, Ian? Do you want to start?
Well, interestingly, our opening speaker tomorrow morning at the Alternative View event is Brian Gerrish, and he has spent the last few years exposing the excesses of a charity called Common Purpose, which is an extremely surreptitious organisation that is putting its tentacles into both corporate and the public arena.
But one could say it's just being private about what it does.
Well, it could, yes. It's extremely secretive about what it does. Local authorities are spending large sums of money on being secretive. But that's another subject. But Brian's subject tomorrow is child stealing by the state. And Brian, for some time, has been concerned at the increasing secretiveness of these family courts, which are generally held in camera, which, of course, is in secret.
Well, there have been moves, actually, earlier this year to open up the family courts more. I mean, they're not totally open, but it looks like that the legal profession would probably agree with you that they should have been more open, and they have been made a bit more open.
Some have, but nonetheless, I mean, it does seem that there are certain elements within the state organisations that are extremely quick to remove children from the family unit. And
but we had this massive baby pee scandal, didn't we, earlier on in the year?
Exactly.
Where I mean, there's obviously people are looking at that and thinking, goodness me, you know, these social workers actually do need a little bit more clout in order to take away children from families where they're being abused.
Well, what they need is common sense. And you know, generally, what they need is experience of the family themselves. You know, unfortunately, there are many people working in social services that don't have those experiences. And tragically, and I know this from my discussions, you know, with some people on a similar subject, there are a lot of people, you know, working in social services who were abused themselves. And so they approach their profession, if you like, with some preconception that all families are prone to abuse. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment that there should be free rein, but I think that, you know, this is something that has to be monitored very, very carefully. There have to be the appropriate checks. There have to be the right balances. And, you know, where possible, of course, we should be encouraging the family unit. But we're seeing a lot of pressure on being put upon the family unit from many, many angles. And, I mean, this includes, you know, mandatory sex education from, what, five upwards now. I mean, this is, you know, for me, it's just outrageous.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this story? I mean, the social workers do get a bit of a bad press, don't they, ultimately? I mean, this is another example of why the pink finger is being pointed at social workers again, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to comment on the individual case because I think it's inappropriate. Unless you really know what's happening in this case, you might be making the wrong assumption either way.
So you're saying you think the story's wrong?
No, I don't think the story's wrong. All I can say is that commenting on an individual case like this is a bad way to proceed. I mean, we know what's, you know, it raises the general area of what is the responsibility of the family, what is the responsibility of society. But as I said when we were discussing this topic the other week, when Baby Peter tragedy took place, I think it was a woman MP in the House of Commons got up and made a very pertinent point in my view. She said that in Britain every year 250 children are murdered by their carers. And, of course, that's finally murdering them. There's an awful lot of people who are abusing their children but not murdering them. Of those 250 murdered, only 60 are actually known to social services. So the tip of the iceberg, the first time you hear about most child murders by carers in this country is when the murder takes place. So you can hardly argue that social services are on top of the problem as it currently exists. I think being a social worker is very difficult because if you don't take people away and they are murdered, then you get the blame. And if you do take kids away, well, people don't like it, and for good reason, because obviously the default thing is for people to live with their parents.
But what about the psychological pressure that's put on families when they are being constantly monitored week after week by social services?
Well, I mean, that's a professional matter, isn't it? Some people need to be monitored. Baby P's parents needed to be monitored. I'm all in favour of families having rights, but children also have rights which transcend those of being in a particular family. They do have a right to not be abused and not be hurt by their carers. And society as a whole has to take some kind of supervisory function over this. We can't have a sort of in loco parentis thing as they had in the Roman Empire, where if a father killed his son, the law could take no action. We don't live in that kind of society.
But Ian, this talk tomorrow morning, child stealing by the state, don't you think that's a little bit alarmist?
Well, I think that I would encourage people to come along and, you know, really make that decision for themselves. You know, Brian Gerrish is a guy who is very sound in his research. You know, he doesn't present anything unless he has the supporting facts. So, you know, this is the whole point of the alternative view, you know, is to give people the opportunity to come to hear a range of speakers, you know, that they probably wouldn't otherwise necessarily go and hear. I can promise you there will be a theme running through the weekend, and I can absolutely assure you that I would challenge anybody to go away from this weekend or even any of the lectures this weekend and say they actually didn't learn anything.
Okay, we've got another news story now, and here's Marina Morris to tell us all about it. Marina, what is it this week?
This week, Ukraine is in the news with a major swine flu outbreak. Ukraine is unprepared for its current flu outbreak, this official closing schools and universities, imposing travel restrictions and limiting public gathering. Many suspect that politics, not health issues, are behind the uproar. Official statistics as of 11th of November show that around 1.2 million Ukrainians are affected this flu among the 46 million population. There are, however, three main flu virus in Ukraine, leading to concerns that the flu virus might mutate. 213 recent deaths in Ukraine have been attributed to flu. Around 63,000 have been hospitalized. Of them, 26,000 have been discharged. 17 regions of 27 in Ukraine are under quarantine, including the capital Kyiv. The impact is greatest in the west of the country, but cases in the east are now increasing. Official Ukrainian government forecast at the worst case, one in four of Ukrainian population will get swine flu or a mutation of it during the next 12 or 18 months. This is about 12 million people, this 1% of them requiring hospitalization. Experts say Ukraine was unprepared for the swine flu outbreak. Most masks and anti-flu pills are out of stock at the moment. At the government request on the 2nd of November, the World Health Organization sent a team to help Ukraine deal with the outbreak. However, they have stated that there is no evidence that Ukraine's outbreak is particularly severe, leading some political analysts to say Ukraine's politicians are using the swine flu scare to earn political points ahead of the country's presidential election in January. The government has faced growing criticism of its handling of the outbreak. The Ukrainian health minister, Vasily Knyazevich, has asked the media only to report the comments of a medical expert following a series of misleading reports which fueled public anxiety. On national television, he said Ukraine has the same problem as the rest of the world. He also called on fellow politicians to give people a week of silence and said there was no need for panic. Many people in Ukraine live in apartments blocks, this communal heating system, which they can't control. Temperatures forecast for the capital Kyiv for the next week range between 3 and 9 degrees centigrade. However, this a continental climate, it might get significantly colder soon. Last winter, the Russian government cut off Ukraine's gas supply. If this happens again, the swine flu situation could rapidly deteriorate. There are a number of conspiracy theories replicating themselves on the internet that this flu outbreak in Ukraine could have been caused intentionally by the release of a vaccine from a company called Baxter International Ukrainian Facility on outcome this Joseph Moshe, a Mossad Israel Secret Service biological warfare expert predicted on an August radio program. There are also stories that United States operated planes built in Russia and Ukraine, the Antonov-124, have been used to spread biological agents in the atmosphere. Some Chinese authorities believe this is an attempt to commit mass genocide. On October 31st, Kyiv newspaper editor got dozens of calls about light planes doing aerosol spraying during the day. If refuting the claims, the district's emergency response office said no permission had been granted for small aviation aircraft to fly within the city limits. Yet eyewitness accounts from Lviv, Chernobyl and other Ukrainian cities said the same things. However, this situation was created. It reminds of great concern to the people of the region and potential alarm to the people of the world to whom any new flu mutation could spread. Official Ukrainian sources are indicating that the situation appears to be stabilizing. On the 3rd of November, the Ukrainian parliament passed a law allocating 1 billion hryvnia, around 75 million pounds, to fund diagnostic and other equipment and drugs for the nation hospitals to fight H1N1 swine flu. Relevant medical knowledge and information is being provided. Ukraine has learned from world's experience. Ukrainian psychologists are recommending a positive attitude and to follow the guidance given. We will continue to monitor the situation with interest and wish the 46 million people in Ukraine good health. Будь здоров!
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Ian, this is all calmed down now. Apparently, this was a massive in Ukraine over the last couple of weeks, but they've asked for a period of silence. What are your thoughts about what's been going on over in Ukraine? Because it does sound like certainly last week and last weekend, there was actually a situation of mass panic.
Yeah, there was. There was indeed. And, you know, one has to say that it is just remarkably coincidental that the source of the outbreak seems to be in very close proximity to Baxter's facility in the Ukraine. And, of course, the initial outbreak in Mexico back in April 22nd, was also in very close proximity to a Baxter facility. And, you know, I think that there's no question that this is being hyped up. You know, the number of deaths so far from swine flu are really not that significant. They're far lower than the deaths from, you know, normal flu outbreak. And whilst I'm not for one moment making light of it, but, you know, flu every year, unfortunately, has a culling effect, if you like, on humanity. And it does, you know, target some, you know, 300,000 people in Europe every winter. And the swine flu isn't coming even close to that. Yet the pharmaceutical companies, particularly companies like GlaxoSmithKline, like Baker, like Novartis, are making mega millions out of the swine flu vaccine being promoted in as the counter to this scare. And in fact, just 10 days ago in The Times, Liam Donaldson, the British government's chief medical advisor, suggested that anybody questioning the efficacy of the swine flu vaccine was, and I quote, an extremist.
Well, I mean, it seems quite sensible what the Ukrainian government have done, and that is to say, as Marina was just telling us, that the only people commenting on it should be medical experts. And you're not a medical expert.
No, and in fact, I make that very, very clear in my new DVD, which I released about 2 months ago now, called The Truth Injection. And I open the DVD by stating categorically that I am not a medical practitioner and that nobody should take anything I say at face value. But, you know, I was presenting my research and I was actually encouraging people to do their own research. And really, the point of putting that DVD out there was because what I perceive is that we are about to endure a mega PR campaign, government-backed PR campaign, to try and encourage everybody to volunteer for the swine flu vaccine. And of course, the GPs have some pretty serious financial motivation to encourage their patients to get this swine flu vaccine, because they're being offered, I think it's £5.19 for every swine flu vaccination that they give. And then they're being given a further incentive if they manage to vaccinate, I think it's 85% of people on their register.
But what you appear to be doing here is trying to discredit the experts and discredit doctors.
Well, what's interesting for me is I picked up an American scientist, a new scientist, a couple of weeks ago. And they both ran articles on swine flu and on the swine flu vaccine. And I can tell you that I have rarely read any more myopic reports, and I did not expect to read this type of report in science magazines. And basically what they're doing is they are being totally either cognitively dissonant or willfully ignorant of the facts that are irrefutable surrounding the situation that occurred in 1976 regarding the concocted a swine flu scam that occurred in the US in 1976, and the subsequent deaths from the swine flu vaccine, and the incredible number of cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is effectively a form of paralysis, which and some people are still alive today that are impacted by that. And for these publications not to even mention that, it's just completely outrageous.
But surely not all these experts can be, and magazines can be, financially motivated, being effectively bribed by the pharmaceutical
industry.
Listen,
Tony, as you know, I mean, I have been for the last few years trying to promote awareness of a thing called Codex Alimentarius. And let me tell you, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is close on a $1 trillion industry. Right? And there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the Codex Alimentarius agenda, which has been in place now through a process of gradualism for the last 50 years, and ultimately the whole process is for the pharmaceutical industry to effectively dominate the whole of healthcare. And the pharmaceutical industry, tragically, have a very simple but very lucrative business model. And that business model is that every human life form, from the moment of conception to the moment of death, is a potential revenue stream. And this, for me, is another part of that.
Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts on what's been going on in Ukraine? And do you think we've got anything to learn from the panic that there was over there at the weekend and last week?
Well, I would just reiterate that I'm not a medical expert either, but I certainly agree very much with the analysing the economic interests behind most of what's going on, because we're not just being presented with dispassionate medical opinions here, are we? As Ian's just pointed out, the Mexican thinker Ivan Illich wrote a book called Medical Nemesis, which just came out in the 1970s, and basically making the case that Ian has just made, that the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, especially if it's privately owned and driven by a private profit motivation, what they want is ill health and interventions to stop that ill health, all of which are revenue streams. Now, this is not medical, dispassionate medical advice. I think that's why we ought to have things like medical officers and so on, general medical officers like Liam Donaldson. They're supposed to be independent because they're not paid by the industry. But of course, that's not always the case. You have what you call regulatory capture, where somebody who's supposed to be independent is in fact in the pocket of the industry, a bit like the Bank of England and the banks.
Well, let me just give you one very specific example of this. I mean, there's still a lot of concern about the HPV vaccine. And of course, just a few weeks ago, we had the young lass in Birmingham who died after having the HPV vaccine.
Now, HPV. Sorry, what is the HPV?
The human papillomavirus, which is one of the drivers behind the cervical cancer. And the pharmaceutical industry for the last few years have been pushing governments to effectively make HPV vaccine a 13-year-old schoolgirls mandatory. Now, this is the case in some states in the US. It was first introduced by Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who made it mandatory for all 13-year-old girls to be vaccinated with HPV. And they're using a vaccine called Gardasil. And now, in the UK, it was Ofsted who made the recommendation that all 13-year-old girls should be encouraged to have the HPV vaccine. In fact, some very underhand tactics are being used in the schools, like the vaccine teams turning up unannounced and effectively putting pressure on the girls to get the vaccine without seeking parental consent, which is completely outrageous. But then, and this is, I'm going to be very, very specific here, because you know, I know the guy's name. There's a guy called Paul Blackburn, and he is the chief financial officer and senior vice president of GlaxoSmithKline, who make a vaccine, HPV vaccine, called Cervix. And consequently, this guy, sitting on Ofsted, effectively encouraging his compatriots on Ofsted to make this recommendation to the government, is obviously a classic example of a conflict of interest.
Well, it's pretty worrying to think that the pharmaceutical industry, with all these profit motives, are actually in these so-called independent government panels. Martin, do you want to have a final word on this? And will you be taking the little jab in the arm?
Well, I don't think I'm going to get cervical cancer. I might have another kind of
swine flu, I was actually going to say.
Well, I mean, I by and large, like most blokes, take the view that I don't want to go anywhere near a doctor unless I'm dying, which probably is a very, very poor attitude. I don't want to have strong opinions about medical things which I don't feel competent to analyse, but certainly the economic motives behind things need to be looked at. We're not just getting independent advice here. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld, for example, we mentioned him earlier. He's a big shareholder in Tamiflu, and when people say, "Oh, panic, you must buy this," well, just check what the real interests are that are going on here.
Okay, next story. We also hear announced yesterday that 37 BBC staff earn more than the Prime Minister. This is a fit of openness by the senior manager at the BBC, where we hear that the broadcaster has said that 107 most senior decision makers earn £22 million a year, and said that's all together, and said that the disclosures made it the nation's most transparent public body. Well, actually, isn't this really a good thing? Martin, do you want to start on this?
A good thing in what sense?
Well, the BBC are now totally open about what they're paying all their senior management.
Well, we should certainly know that. Since we're all BBC licence payers, we ought to know what's going on.
This idea that you've got nearly 40 staff being paid more than the Prime Minister?
Being paid more than the Prime Minister is no big deal. I mean, if you look at the private sector, virtually everybody in a senior position in the private sector is being paid more than the Prime Minister. people go into politics for not for making money in the immediate short term. Mr. Blair is now making his money by being on the rubber chicken circuit, being invited to, you know, to go and talk to people and so on. So prime ministers tend to make their money after they've been in power rather than when they're in power. And I think we've got a problem with politicians as a whole, which is for the kind of level of responsibility they have, they're not actually paid at comparable levels, even with the civil service, let alone with the private sector. And of course, it all sounds like a lot of money, but I mean, you've got to compare like with like.
But what about this principle? Should the BBC, as we pay for, and we are forced to pay for, if we want a television, should they be paying the same sort of figures that there are in the private sector? Because this is something which has changed over the years.
If they're in competition with the private sector for attracting people to work for them, then they have to actually pay the going rate. Otherwise, the people won't work for them. It's as simple as that. Maybe some people are paid far more than they're worth in a general sense in society. That's another issue. But if you're in competition with ITV or CBS or whatever it is, and they're paying the going rate, if you don't pay the going rate as the BBC, you won't get the people who can do the job.
Ian, what do you think? Do you think this is a good thing that we're now seeing some more openness amongst the senior management at the BBC, and we can see what they're being paid compared to other people like the Prime Minister?
I think transparency is always a good thing. I've got to tell you, obviously having come from the oil industry, at the end of the day, it is a classic case. If you want talent, you've got to be prepared to pay for it. I think, you know, we get into the other debate, is the BBC getting the biggest bang for its buck in terms of the talent that it's paying for with that money?
Okay, Marina's with us again with another story. I think it's mobile phones this time,
oh, yes.
Marina, isn't
it? About mobile phone. At about 80 million, there are now more mobiles than people in the UK. But since the 90s, when their use became more widespread, there have been nagging doubt about their safety. For many people, this was resolved 2 years ago, this report from the Mobile Telecommunication and Health Research Programme. The Interphone Inquiry has been investigation where exposure to mobile phone is linked to 3 type of brain tumor and tumor of the salivary gland. The project conducted studies in 13 countries, interviewed tumor sufferers and people in good health to use whether their mobile phone use different. It questioned about 13,000 people between 2000 and 2004. The findings show that 6 of 8 interphone studies found some rise in the risk of glioma, the most common brain tumor. This one finding, a 39% increase in risk. Long-term use of mobile phones may be linked to some cancer. A landmark international study will conclude later this year. A £20 million decade-long investigation overseen by the World Health Organization will publish evidence that heavy users face a high risk of developing brain tumor later in life. The conclusion, while not definitive, will undermine assurance from the government that devices are safe and is expected to put minister under pressure to issue stronger guidance. A preliminary breakdown of the results found a significantly increased risk of some brain tumor related to use of mobile phones of period of 10 years or more in some studies. The head of the Interphone investigation said that the report would include public health messages. Britain's Department of Health has not updated its guidance for more than 4 years. It said the current balance of evidence does not show health problems causing by using mobile phones and suggest only the children be discouraged from making non-essential calls while adults should keep calls short. In contrast, several other countries, notably France, have begun warns and American politicians are urgently investigating the risk. 2 of 7 studies into account neuromyelia, a benign tumor of a nerve between the ear and brain. A summary said a definitive link could not be proved because of difficult this subject memories. A spokesman for the Mobile Operator Association said more than 30 scientific reviews had found no adverse health effects.
Well, at least that last bit is a bit of good news. We do have, Ian, here, a report which is saying that although they can't actually directly link the two, we've got up to around about 40% increase in brain cancers for people that are regular users of mobile phones. And also, as Marina was saying there, our own Department of Health issues very, very little in the way of guidance as to how healthy these things are. Now, why is that? Is this, again, just a failure of regulation, do you think?
Well, I mean, once again, let's look at the phenomenal economics of the mobile phone industry. I mean, the money involved here is incredible. The tragedy is that there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that a number of people are seriously adversely affected by their exposure to all the radio waves. And of course, it's increasing at a phenomenal rate. I mean, there was one survey by a scientific investigator in Bridgend, in the cluster of suicides there, particularly teenage suicides. Now, he didn't come up with a conclusion, but one of the things that he identified in his investigation, which interestingly enough was not picked up by the government, and in fact they tried to shut him down, was that there were two things that he was concerned about. One was the prevalence of Ritalin, and all of the children, or young people I should say, who committed suicide were either taking Ritalin or were coming off of Ritalin. But there were other children taking Ritalin who hadn't committed suicide. But they also, all the children who, or young people who had committed suicide, all lived within 250 metres of a phone mast. So he just put this out there and was actually trying to encourage that there should be full and further scientific investigation, but it was shut down. Now, I've got to tell you that one of the speakers that we've invited for AV4 is the managing director of a major company in this country, and he is Wi-Fi susceptible. He cannot function. I mean, it completely debilitates him to be in and around any Wi-Fi or mobile phone masts. And, you know, he knows when he's sort of coming into proximity with this, because obviously, his health starts to suffer. And he's going to be talking about, you know, his experiences as a senior manager in British industry and trying to cope with, his condition.
OK, I want to stop you there because your speaker, Cynthia McKinney, this evening, she's doing a talk entitled, I believe, 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld and the Missing Trillions. And now let's have a listen to one of your guests. That's her. Ex-Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, taking part in a 2007 congressional inquiry looking into the trillion-dollar overspends year after year at the Department of Defense, and, Defense in the United States. And here she is grilling Donald Rumsfeld.
Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
Thank you, Representative. The second question. I've forgotten what the second question was.
So there's Donald Rumsfeld there replying to Cynthia McKinney's questions about the $2.3 trillion overspend and $1.1 trillion overspend. Ian, how on earth do they get figures like this?
Well, it is just outrageous. But, I mean, let's also not forget that announcement was made to the media, i.e. the announcement that the Pentagon could not account for $2.3 trillion, was actually made on September the 10th, one day before the events of 9/11.
Well, that actually, just to clarify, that was later. That was, she's asking these questions again because they haven't been answered.
Exactly. No, she was a terrier, which is why obviously the Republicans made sure that she didn't get re-elected in 2004. But I mean, she is a remarkable lady. I mean, she really was on the case, was on the ball. She was one of the few congresswomen that was asking these guys the poignant questions, and of course now. Subsequent to that, you know, she has taken on the mantle of a human rights campaigner, and last December she was on board the Dignity when it was rammed by the Israeli Navy, and she was with one of her colleagues, a guy called Dr. David Halpin. And David Halpin is totally of the opinion that the Israeli Navy intention was to sink the ship.
Okay, anyway, just to round up, you're doing a talk yourself. Cynthia's also doing one on Sunday. You're doing a talk yourself called The Green Agenda and Population Reduction. Can you sum that up in 30 seconds before we go
really,
up to the news?
What I'm going to show you is that, you know, it is written in tablets of stone, and I will show you those tablets of stone, that there is a desire by a certain elements within those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of this planetary fiefdom. They have a desire to reduce the population to 500 million, i.e. a reduction of about 80-odd percent. And what I'm going to show is that a lot of what is occurring right now is, in my opinion, part of that agenda, and a lot of the green movement is effectively being hijacked under things like Agenda 21 and the Earth First movement to bring that about.
Okay, well, we'll be hearing from one of your speakers after the news at 6 o'clock. So thanks, Ian, very much for your time.
Thank
now
you
better
Tony.
Scurry off to your conference.
Thanks a lot.
3.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.